Does the North Korean president pose a genuine threat to world security? What is America's true motive for targeting North Korea for regime change? How has America's nuclear policy changed since the era of the Cold War? How has the U.S. managed to co-opt the UN into enabling crimes against the peace going back to the first Iraq War? Might the U.S. be on the verge of launching a military attack on North Korea? On this week's Global Research NewsHour, as efforts to de-escalate the Korean crisis are being sabotaged at the UN, we take an in-depth look at some of the background behind the confrontation between the US and North Korea, as well as the evolution of America's nuclear strategy from the dark days of the Cold War to the Trump era. Our guests for the hour are Professor Michel Chossadovsky of the Center for Research on Globalization and Carla Stea, the Center's correspondent at the United Nations. On this week's program, Targeting North Korea, Can a Nuclear War Be Avoided? Conversations with Michel Chossadovsky and Carla Stea. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of December 15th, 2017. I'm series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with news notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. In addition to Free Press's plan to sue the FCC, the group urged supporters to push Congress to nullify Pai's plan using the Congressional Review Act, or CRA, which allows representatives and senators to review new regulations and overrule them by passing a joint resolution. 40 senators, including one Republican, have voiced opposition to the net neutrality rollback, while a handful of Republican representatives have said they disagree with Pai's plan. But the loudest opposition so far has come from the public and groups like Free Press and Fight for the Future. "Why are we witnessing such an unprecedented groundswell of public support for net neutrality?" asked Clyburn in her dissent. Quote, "Because the public can plainly see a soon-to-be toothless FCC is handing the keys to the internet to a handful of multi-billion dollar corporations," unquote. With the vote, ISPs like Verizon, Pai's former employer, will no longer be prohibited from blocking or slowing down certain websites and content, and will be able to charge fees to web companies that can afford to pay them for access to an internet fast lane, leaving smaller sites struggling to reach audiences. That comes from the article, "Net Neutrality Killed as FCC Hands Keys to Internet to Handful of Multi-Billion Dollar Corporations," by Julia Conley, posted December 15th, originally appearing at Common Dreams. FreePress.net said the following in response to Thursday's ruling. "It abdicated FCC authority over internet service providers, clearing the way for blocking, throttling, and discrimination by the nation's largest phone and cable companies. Free Press will take the FCC to court to challenge its reversal on the proper definition of broadband, the accuracy of its contentious justifications for tossing out the rules, and the many process fouls that have plagued the FCC proceedings since it began earlier this year. New York Attorney General Eric Schneiderman intends suing against what he called an illegal ruling. Other states intend to sue, the ACLU, Electronic Frontier Foundation, and other consumer groups likely to follow suit or file amicus briefs supporting litigation against the FCC ruling. That comes from the article, "Net Neutrality Foregone? FCC Votes to Kill Digital Democracy Towards a Corporate Swamp of Media Disinformation?" by Stephen Lendman, posted December 15th. If you've heard the term net neutrality, is it something you imagine only internet fanatics can grasp? Not at all. It simply refers to baseline protection, ensuring that no internet service provider can, quote, interfere with or block web traffic, or favor their own services at the expense of smaller rivals, unquote. As such, it is integral to democratic dialogue. To abolish it, explains Craig Aaron, president and CEO of the media advocacy group Free Press, quote, would end the open nature of the internet and leave activists, media makers, and all the rest of us at the mercy of the biggest phone and cable companies, unquote. That comes from the article, We Saved Net Neutrality Once, We Can Do It Again, by Francis Moore LaPay and Adam Eichen, posted December 14th, originally appearing at Common Dreams. On Monday, the Federal Communications Commission and the Federal Trade Commission released a draft Memorandum of Understanding on the ways the two agencies will allegedly work together to protect internet users after the FCC guts the open internet protections in a vote on December 14th. In statement accompanying the MOU, FCC Chairman Ajit Pai falsely claimed that this joint agency approach, quote, protected a free and open internet for many years prior to the FCC's 2015 Title II order, unquote. In reality, jurisdiction over communications networks and net neutrality has always rested with the FCC. Even before the FCC rightly returned to Title II of the Communications Act as the basis for the net neutrality rules, the agency always retained its claim to jurisdiction over open internet principles and the internet service providers that violated them. If the FCC adopts PI's proposal to overturn these rules, internet users will be exposed to blocking, throttling, and paid prioritization of online content by the handful of ISPs that control access in the United States. That comes from the article, Net Neutrality. FCC Chairman Pai attempts to rewrite the legal history of a bogus agreement. Posted December 12th, originally appearing at Free Press. YouTube has already removed over 150,000 videos, 50% of which were removed within 2 hours of upload. The company is working to accelerate the rate of takedown through machine learning from manual censorship, according to YouTube CEO Susan Wojcicki in an official blog post. The hiring drive by Google is yet another advance in the campaign against any expression of political opposition. Other social media giants have implemented measures against quote-unquote fake news. Facebook has altered its algorithms to reduce the visibility of certain news stories, and Twitter has banned the Russian-funded media outlets RT and Sputnik from advertising on the platform. While railing against the extremist content, child exploitation, and hoaxes in the interest of public safety, the ultimate goal of this campaign is the suppression of left-wing anti-war sentiment. That comes from the article, Google Hiring 10,000 Reviewers to Censor YouTube Content, by Zaida Green. Posted December 10th, originally appearing at World Socialist website. Though the agency has always enjoyed a cozy relationship with the industries it regulates, ever since the Trump administration arrived in Washington, the FCC's mission to preserve the public commons has been threatened and assaulted and torn asunder. And like a bad horror movie cliche, these calls to eviscerate the FCC have been coming from inside the agency. Repealing net neutrality has drawn a huge amount of public visibility, and rightly so. But that decision is just the latest in a string of ominous, industry-friendly giveaways by the Trump administration's FCC. It has also rolled back local TV station ownership limits on media giants like Sinclair Broadcast Group and rescinded the longtime Maine studio rule that required local stations to maintain community newsrooms and fostered more local journalism. And the agency's leadership has begun a campaign to actively abdicate its enforcement mission and pass it over to the smaller, less well-funded Federal Trade Commission, which lacks the FCC's deep industry knowledge and proactive regulatory power. That comes from the article, Net Neutrality Repeal is Only Part of Trump's Surrender to Corporate Media, by Reed Richardson, posted December 15th, originally appearing at the FAIR website. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Well, we are joined now by Michel Chossudovsky. He is professor of economics emeritus at the University of Ottawa and founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization in Montreal. He is the editor of Global Research, and he's an award-winning author of 11 books, including The Globalization of Poverty in the New World Order, Towards a World War III Scenario, The Dangers of Nuclear War, and The Globalization of War, America's Long War Against Humanity. And he is preparing talks in Hamilton and Toronto and potentially other cities across Canada. So he joins us right now. How are you doing today, Professor Chossudovsky?
Good afternoon. Pleasure to be on the program.
So tell us a little bit about these talks. What in particular is your concern as you go to these different events?
Well, the danger of nuclear annihilation, which appears to be very abstract, is a reality. And it becomes a reality once it happens. People are incapable of conceptualizing. We have a lot of scientific evidence. We have, of course, we also have Hiroshima, Nagasaki, where 100,000 people died in Hiroshima in the first 7 seconds. Today's bombs are at least 100 times more powerful, the strategic nuclear bombs. The tactical nuclear weapons, which have been recategorized by the U.S. Senate as conventional weapons, can go from one-third to six times a Hiroshima bomb. And the latest version, the B-61-12, could go up to 12 times a Hiroshima bomb. But they call them mini-nukes. And scientific opinion on contract to the Pentagon says, quote, that they are harmless to the surrounding civilian population because the explosion is underground. These are bunker buster bombs. They have a different delivery system to the so-called strategic nuclear weapons. But they're thermonuclear bombs, and they're pretty much the same type of bombs with different yields. That yields means explosive capacity. So the situation is tremendously dangerous. Now, there's another thing which people do not know, and it's of extreme importance. The Manhattan Project started up in 1939. It was initially a U.S. project, and then Britain and also Canada joined the Manhattan Project, and Canadian science and technology was applied to the Manhattan Project. I won't get into the details, but Canada is deeply integrated into the nuclear weapons project right from the outset. And in fact, we might be described as a de facto nuclear power, because there was exchange of information, there were agreements, there was the Quebec Agreement, I believe it was in 1942, 43, and so on and so forth. But what's very important is that in 1942, the United States had already designed a project to bomb the Soviet Union. And that happened when the Soviet Union and the Allies were fighting Nazi Germany. They were allies. And in 1945, September 15th, 1945, barely 1 month after Hiroshima was on the 6th of August, Nagasaki was on the 9th of August. And less than a month later, they release a secret document which essentially reads as follows: 204 atomic bombs against 66 major cities of the Soviet Union. It was a U.S. nuclear attack against the USSR, which were formulated during World War II. Now, what is the significance of this plan? If the United States had not had the intent of blowing up the Soviet Union, of wiping the Soviet Union off the map, we would not have had an arms race. Okay? we would not have had an arms race, and the world would be much safer today. So that's one very important dimension. Now, when we turn to looking at North Korea and China, I think it's important to stress that North Korea and China have been threatened for 67 years. In fact, the first threat was formulated shortly after China declared its liberation, or the foundation of the People's Republic of China, which was in October 1949. And so in early 1950, or I think it was mid-1950, the United States had already plans to attack China and also to attack North Korea with nuclear weapons. And then we have to say North Korea is a nuclear weapon state, but so is Israel. North Korea is a nuclear weapon state, but so is Turkey. It has tactical nuclear weapons under national command in its Incirlik Air Force base. And there are other countries. And there we have a small country in East Asia, which now has been tagged by the media as a threat to global security.
I think that one of the reasons the public has a lot of concern about the threat posed by North Korea is the portrayal of the president as being unstable, insane. Here he is with all these tests that every time some concern is expressed, they're conducting one more test, you know, firing missiles into the sea, intercontinental ballistic missile testing. And so we're seeing this response on the part of the U.S. president. Granted, a lot of the public messaging is that both Trump and Kim Jong-il are insane and essentially holding the world hostage. But can you address that? I mean, do you believe the North Korean president is behaving rationally?
Well, listen, we can always look at narratives. The narrative of the North Korean leader may appear eclectic at moments, threatening, but in effect, all they have done is to test their missiles and test their nuclear weapons. But on the other hand, if you want to look at concrete occurrences, for the last 67 years, the United States has been threatening to obliterate North Korea. And that was fire and fury. It was not invented by Donald Trump. It goes back to the Truman Doctrine. And I can quote from tons of documents. They killed 30% of our population and then say North Korea is threatening America. There's not a single family in North Korea that hasn't lost a loved one in the course of the Korean War. Those are the realities. And then another thing, eclectic nuthead in North Korea actually instructed, he's the head of state or the head of the party and the leader, his government actually signed and gave a yes vote to a motion in the United Nations General Assembly to eliminate nuclear weapons, to prohibit nuclear weapons, to make them illegal. And then there were 38 countries that voted against it. Of course, Canada was one of them. Though I, as a Canadian, I say, well, most Canadians are against nuclear weapons, yet our government did not sign the motion, which is now the object of a Nobel Prize, to prohibit nuclear weapons. But the guy in Pyongyang, he gave the green light to signing that resolution. Now, there's something wrong there. I think we have to distinguish between political rhetoric on the one hand, and I concur that his rhetoric is not encouraging. Okay, he makes statements which are a little bit off, but that I don't think that really makes it. It's ammunition for the media. Not a single media has actually acknowledged the fact that North Korea endorsed the prohibition of nuclear weapons. Something like 120 countries said yes. All the NATO member states said no. Some of them abstained. But and Canada also endorsed. Canada said no. So there we have to look. We have to understand a bit the history of the Korean Peninsula. I should mention another thing. South Korea was for 10 years, and that was official, a nuclear weapons state.
What makes North Korea such a focus of attention, at least in the media, and apparently in terms of U.S. foreign policy? It doesn't obviously have any resources like oil that would be coveted by the U.S. and its partners. So why this fuss over North Korea? Just because they've got the nuclear bomb? And
I think there are two important issues pertaining to that question. One is that North Korea has a societal project which departs from the diktats of global capitalism. Okay? Whether we like it or not, they're a socialist country. They have their own way of organizing economic activity, social programs, and so on. And any country which departs from the norm of neoliberalism, which exercises its sovereignty, is immediately a target. And we saw that.
Yugoslavia.
We saw that in Syria and Iraq. Okay, mm-hmm. We see it in many different countries. But I think that's the first. But the second has to do with the fact that North Korea is a buffer state, and it is it has borders with China, and it has borders with Russia. The city of Vladivostok is about 100 kilometers from the North Korean border, and both Russia and China are the target of the United States. The war on North Korea is a stepping stone to a possible stepping stone to a broader war, and it's also a war of consolidation in East Asia, where the United States has established its spheres of influence, well, in East Asia, but also in Southeast Asia.
If they're looking for a way of de-escalating things vis-a-vis the United States, what options realistically do they have?
Well, first of all, there is the option of signing a peace treaty, which the North Koreans have been insisting upon for many, many years. But the United States has always refused to sign a peace agreement. In other words, a peace agreement would be signed by the three parties of the Armistice Agreement of 1953. Now, that armistice agreement was signed by the United States, the DPRK, and China, because China had what they call the Chinese Volunteers Army. So those are the three signatories of the armistice agreement. But there seems to be a dead end there, because systematically Washington said we're not entering into any kind of peace negotiations, or that they set conditions on that. And they've even intimated that they would have to have troops stationed in North Korea if there's a reunification of the two Koreas. So from my standpoint, and I've discussed this a lot with people in South Korea, and it's a project which emanates also from South Korean civil society, is for North Korea and South Korea to enter into an agreement which, in a sense, nullifies the armistice agreement, would be a peace agreement, but at the same time, it would be a means to demilitarize the Korean Peninsula. Because at this moment, and that's very, very important, at this moment, the Republic of Korea, namely South Korea, has a bilateral agreement with the United States. It's called the ROK-US Combined Forces Command, the CFC. Now, what that joint command signifies is that in case of war, the United States would take over the entire military apparatus of South Korea. In other words, all the forces of South Korea would be under U.S. command. That is called operational control, OPCON. It's the OPCON of both the Republic of Korea and U.S. military forces, and they've signed an agreement which essentially says, okay, if there's war, well, President Moon, the president of South Korea, has absolutely no power. He's not commander-in-chief. He's only commander-in-chief when there's peace, so that's a non-sequitur. And then Washington dictates its conditions, and ultimately, through OPCOM, it controls the whole, all military operations in East Asia. So that even if, let's say, United States wanted to attack China, it could then mobilize Korean forces, and they would be under the command of a four-star general appointed by the Pentagon. So that what has to be achieved is that for this North-South peace agreement, coupled with cooperation, cultural exchange, and so on, some of which has been ongoing, but it started with Kim Dae-jung in 1998, and then it was interrupted I don't want to go into the details of the history, but the thing is that if North and South Korea, through dialogue, establish a peace agreement whereby they agree that the OPCOM, ROK and U.S. agreement is nullified, that's something that they can do, so that operational control of the United States over Republic of Korea forces is nullified, combined, let's say, with the withdrawal of some 27,000 troops, U.S. troops in South Korea. What this could signify is that the armistice agreement would, in a sense, be sidetracked by a bilateral North-South peace agreement, in other words, which would de facto lead to rescinding the 1953 armistice. That is Plan B. And in effect, that Plan B is much more realistic than Plan A, because the United States has refused to enter into any kind of peace negotiations with North Korea and China, which would then so that the armistice agreement is still there. And the armistice agreement, we know, doesn't necessarily lead to the end of a war. It simply means it's a you stop fighting, but the war is still there. So
ceasefire.
Legally, the war is still there.
Yeah.
Because there was never a peace agreement.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. Right now, the United States seems to be facing a major economic crisis. They've pretty much outsourced a lot of their infrastructure, huge debts that they're not likely to ever pay back. They're overstrained, and you know, and on top of that, and that's something that's prevailed for years. Now you've got a president who's not only somehow, you know, unpredictable and untamed. But he seems to be under assault from within his the governing, you know, the military industrial complex, the deep state, whatever you want to call it. How do you see those factors working together to potentially increase the threat of a nuclear holocaust, be it deliberate or accidental?
Well, I think what disturbs me most is that today we have a situation where competing nuclear powers are not communicating in the same way, let's say, as they were communicating during the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962. President Kennedy and Nikolai Sergeyevich Khrushchev, the Russian leader, were communicating at that time. They had means of communicating. They were both acutely aware of the fact that the use of nuclear weapons would lead to the unthinkable. That was under the doctrine of mutually assured destruction. That doctrine of mutually assured destruction, MAD, prevailed during the Cold War era and was an element of stability, because both sides knew that if they used nuclear weapons, this would be the end of humanity. And they knew it, and they had the scientists who were analyzing it and their policymakers. But today we don't have that.
Well, are you sure? I mean, you don't think Putin understands the potential hazards and that he isn't reaching out to Mr. Trump?
Putin understands them. And there's no first strike preemptive nuclear war doctrine as far as the Russian Federation is concerned. Putin understands it, and he has his whole background enables him to understand it. I don't think that Trump understands it. I don't think that James Mad Dog Mattis, who runs the Pentagon, understands it. And one of the reasons why they don't understand it is that they have created an ideology which upholds nuclear weapons or tactical nuclear weapons as peacemaking bombs. Because what they've done is a little bit like removing the sticker from a cigarette pack and saying, smoking is good for your health.
Health
and
food.
That's exactly what they've done. They've redefined those bombs, saying that they're harmless to civilians.
So
and
one
that's
thing
in
that's
the military
changed.
Manuals.
Yeah. One thing that seems to have changed is that, like back in the 80s, there was the talk about mutually assured destruction, and that was the application of nuclear weapons, and today it's become a part of conventional warfare.
Well, precisely. We're not all of them, but they're now arguing, they're saying, oh, well, we should use these small nuclear bombs because they could insert themselves into a conventional war theater context, and let's go ahead and use them. And in fact, we don't even need to ask President Trump's permission, because the commander, the three-star general in the regional commands, can actually call the shots. That's a point that Daniel Ellsberg brought out in a recent interview, is that the fact that even the commanders in the field have much greater authority to use nuclear weapons than they did previously. It's an extremely dangerous situation, because even the use of a tactical nuclear weapon against North Korea could unleash a third world war. And the reason for that is also the fact that North Korea has borders with China and Russia. Anybody who has some minimal understanding of nuclear radiation knows that this would not be a war against North Korea. It would be a war against China, Russia, South Korea, and Japan. I mean, as I said, for people in Toronto, going from Toronto to Halifax is about the same thing as going from Seoul to the border with North Korea. Everything is very, very close and highly and densely populated. So that we're in a very, very we're at a very dangerous crossroads, and one of the purposes of the the meetings in Hamilton and Toronto is to build a resurgence of Canadian anti-war movement, which has been defunct since the Iraq War 2003. Mm-hmm. Nobody moves. And here we're not talking about one war. I mean, we have the war in Yemen. It's crimes against humanity. We have the war in Syria, the war in Iraq. But the use of nuclear weapons is the destruction of humanity. Fidel Castro said, and I actually, I recorded that statement when I was with him a few years back. He said, in the case of a nuclear war, the collateral damage is humanity in its entirety.
Okay, so Professor Chostovsky, those dates for your lectures again are December 18th in Hamilton, and then another one in Toronto on December 19th. Just one more question before I let you go. Just a quick comment on the media's role in exacerbating or mitigating this new nuclear threat.
Well, you know, what is exacerbating this the nuclear threat is the act of omission. Here we have something which is absolutely crucial, whatever your views, but it's not front page news. And we don't talk about it. Well, and when we do talk about it, we look at the folklore of the North Korean leader and his hairstyle and so on. The public attention today, public opinion is misinformed. They don't know what these bombs can do. They literally will destroy people's lives and destroy the planet. That's not an understatement. That's not an overstatement. It's in fact an understatement, because you can blow up the planet several times. The lie has become the truth. We are led to believe that nuclear weapons are harmless to civilians, and the media is simply mum on the subject. And then when this crazy North Korean leader, they'll say he's crazy and so on and so forth. But why, if he's so crazy, why did he actually say yes to a UN resolution to prohibit and outlaw nuclear weapons when none of the other nuclear weapons states actually supported that resolution? It was the only nuclear weapons state which actually supported that resolution.
Professor Charles,
and whether we like the North Koreans or not, that statement should have been heralded by the mainstream media. And I can tell you, because I reviewed it, you know what they did? They just lumped them together. He said the 9 nuclear weapon states, including North Korea, turned down the motion. Not true. They didn't check the original United Nations Assembly documents. Or maybe they just decided that they were going to lie, and then you can look at it in the Ottawa Citizen, and in fact, very little coverage of it. Mm. On the whole, very, very little coverage of the nuclear weapons, the implications of nuclear weapons, and the importance for humanity to abolish nuclear weapons.
Professor Chostovsky, thank you very much for your time. I wish you all the best in your upcoming speaking events, and a happy holiday season, and all the best in the new year.
All the best to you and everybody in Winnipeg.
Okay.
Bye-bye for now.
Bye-bye. We've been speaking with Professor of Economics Emeritus at the University of Ottawa and founder and director of the Center for Research on Globalization, Michel Chostovsky. Carla Steya is an American journalist and is Global Research's correspondent at the United Nations. She had traveled to North Korea in May of 2017 and came back with a much more positive impression of the country than had been left behind in documents like the Kirby Report. I asked Carla Steya to comment on that Kirby Report and the veracity of the claims therein.
The Kirby Report, I think, was stated, described by Ivan Simonovic, who was Assistant Secretary General for, I believe it was, Humanitarian Affairs at the United Nations, as a report that would not hold up as evidence in a court of law. The report itself, in fact, was based upon a book by a defector who subsequently retracted what he had said and admitted that he had lied. And there were a number of defectors. The report was based on who were paid for their interviews. Obviously, I don't pay people when I interview them, nor am I paid when I'm interviewed. But these defectors were paid, and the sums they were paid were increased to a very large degree the more gruesome the reports they provided. So it was a very lucrative industry to demonize North Korea and describe human rights abuses, which most probably did not exist.
Can you speak then to the issue of how these sanctions, these that have been hitting the DPRK pretty hard? I mean, they go beyond being able to restrict their ability to manufacture nuclear weapons and nuclear armaments. It's contributing to a humanitarian crisis there.
Well, it may be the cause of the humanitarian crisis there. The sanctions, and this was reported with alarm by Mr. Quintana, who was the rapporteur on human rights in North Korea, the sanctions are preventing chemotherapy from getting to cancer patients. They are preventing wheelchairs to be provided to crippled people and equipment for disabled people to be provided to the people of North Korea. The material that's being denied the people, including food, of course, is intended to make their life so unbearable that they'll rise up against the government and overthrow it. But if they don't, which they may not, because the government has been very, very attentive to their needs, they may simply starve to death, or the sanctions may end up making life so unbearable that the people will lose the will that they've had. They've really extraordinary courage and dedication to their socialist way of life, and you can break a people eventually. And I believe that that's the whole purpose of the sanctions. It has very little to do, I think, with restraining the nuclear program, and everything to do with destroying a people. It's a form of genocide, a slow form of genocide, maybe not so slow. And the whole emphasis on tightening the sanctions, I think, is criminal.
There have been some troubling and provocative rhetoric from the Trump administration directed at Pyongyang. I mean, we've seen the nuclear submarines located to the Republic of Korea, South Korea, ongoing military drills. There was Vigilant Ace earlier this month. In addition to the sanctions, is it possible to dismiss all these provocative words and actions as just a bluff, to try to get concessions from the government? Or should we assume that the Trump administration is serious about military action within weeks?
Well, that's very frightening, but you may be correct. The buildup, the three successive military operations, the first with the North Koreans and the United States, the second coming right after that with the North Koreans and the United States, and then the third coming right after that, which was Monday and Tuesday of this week, which was Japan, South Korea, and the United States. Have I been saying South Korea all along? I hope so. Japan, South Korea, and the United States. does not seem to have any let up in the military, intense and terrifying military pressure being put on North Korea. Now, I believe the Chinese and the Russians have come out and accused the West of trying to provoke Kim Jong-un to take a radical action, which would they could then use as justification to attack. There is a joint aid treaty between China and North Korea, in which if North Korea is attacked, China is obliged to come to their aid. But if North Korea attacks first, then China is not. And it's become pretty clear that these military exercises and the armada of nuclear submarines that is now surrounding North Korea are attempts to provoke North Korea to take the first move, which then, of course, will be used to obliterate the country. I don't know. What you've just said is very frightening. I have quite often not allowed myself to think in those terms, and yet everything that is being done is suggesting a plan for a massive attack on the North.
Carla, what hold does the U.S. hold over the U.N. that it would permit yet another disaster to befall the DPRK rather than demand the peaceful negotiations the Pyongyang government has been seeking all along? I mean, are there specific mechanisms and instruments the U.S. is able to wield to allow them to get their way at the U.N.?
I think the U.S. pays for a lot at the U.N. The Japanese, I believe, do as well. Which could indicate why they are able to do what they're doing this month. and the U.S. uses pressures on China for trade. There could be pressures involving Taiwan, pressures involving the South China Sea, the East China Sea. And then, of course, with Russia, they could be trying to make deals using the Crimea. I would say the whole gamut, bribes, threats, manipulation, tremendous pressure to appear publicly to be cooperative. Currently, there is enormous pressure from the Secretary General for there to be unity in the Security Council. And this is a situation where probably the healthiest thing that could happen to the United Nations would be vetoes by Russia and China of what is happening in the United Nations, vetoes of the sanctions, vetoes of any possible naval blockade or any possible military actions.
Carla Stea contacted us on the day the show first went to air with a breaking report from the UN on the latest developments on the North Korean front. So maybe just sort of lay out the main concerns that this meeting was designed to address, and any potential fallout coming out of it.
Well, one thing that disturbed me tremendously was that the Japanese presidency of the Security Council does appear to be abusing its mandate as presidency, and the focus is very much on demonizing North Korea. And the meeting was opened with the Japanese foreign minister, and his rhetoric was extremely bellicose. Again, exaggerating the threat of North Korea. Actually, the French statement was, in fact, the most hyperbolic. And I won't repeat what he said. It's on the record, but it exaggerates any possible threat from North Korea. In fact, North Korea is not a threat, and they will not use nuclear weapons unless they are attacked. The North Korean ambassador did speak, and he said that the country which should be sanctioned for violating the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty is the United States, and that's correct, because the United States is in violation of Article 6 of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which requires it to negotiate in good faith the elimination of all its nuclear weapons, and it very, very conspicuously and aggressively denounced the new treaty to ban nuclear weapons, which is a violation of Article 6 on the part of the United States. It's also in violation of Article 1 of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation, prohibits placing nuclear weapons in countries, and we have nuclear weapons in five countries, including Turkey, Italy, Germany, the Netherlands, and I can't recall what the fifth is, but all five countries are in violation of Article 2 of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, which prohibits accepting nuclear weapons stationed on their territory. So the entire Security Council is essentially some of them voluntarily projecting their own reprehensible behavior onto North Korea. Some of them, no doubt, under pressure from the U.S., the U.K., and France to do so. But you had 15 members denouncing one tiny little country which had been totally obliterated. 3 or 4 million of its citizens had been destroyed in the last nuclear, in the last Korean War, and do not want to endure that again. The sanctions regime was mentioned as violating the humanitarian assistance which North Korea has a right to and which the sanctions are required to protect, but they are not protecting it. Sweden did express concern about this. Several other nations did. There was nothing really effective about it. Focus upon the fact that the sanctions are actually a punitive mechanism and are, as the late Russian ambassador Vitaly Churkin pointed out on numerous occasions, are the purpose of it is to incite regime change and not to not to force North Korea to get its weapons. So there was no real indication of what direction things would be going in based upon this meeting.
Can you say, can you speak at all? Was Rex Tillerson there? Because he was sort of a figure of controversy earlier this week for saying.
Yes, he spoke. And it seems that he has, well, he had originally said that he was willing to meet with no preconditions. It was no longer clear actually what his position is. He seemed more hawk-like than he had appeared to be previously. And I assume that President Trump has told him to give up his dovish approach, which had said, well, we can meet to talk about the weather if you want. We can talk about the shape of the table, but let's just meet face to face. And that, of course, seemed a productive and a very useful approach to a country that feels very threatened and legitimately and realistically threatened. But he seems to have abandoned that, and it was the usual. So there's very little to say. To see 15 council members acting in this fashion, knowing that many of them are colluding with the U.S., there's no word to use, is very, very, very tragic.
Do you have any thoughts about moving ahead in terms of what could be done to perhaps avert the possibility of a war?
Well,
is there any actions that can be taken? Or
actually, I do think one of the most important actions that could be taken, and which was not discussed, is for the Secretary General of the United Nations to appoint the best possible negotiator to negotiate a peace, and that would be former U.S. President Jimmy Carter, who understands North Korea, who has succeeded in the past in averting war and who does respect their position, but who, according to The Guardian, he was someone from the State Department visited him at home and told him to stop speaking publicly.
He wrote an op-ed not too long ago, right? In October?
Yes, he wrote a brilliant op-ed. It was the 5th of October, The Washington Post, and it was entitled What I've Learned from the Leaders of North Korea. And he enumerated about five or six things that are very crucial to them, and none of which would threaten anybody else. They want their own security protected. They want a peace treaty with the United States. No doubt they want a peace treaty with South Korea and with Japan, and they want sanctions lifted, all of which seem to be entirely reasonable requests on their part. And Jimmy Carter, in publishing this, did a great service to clarity on what is actually going on. You have a nation whose survival is threatened and whose survival was essentially obliterated 50 years ago. President Carter, recognizing this, would no doubt be able to negotiate a settlement that was in the interest of all parties and would leave all parties with dignity. But the question is whether or not Secretary General Guterres would appoint him, whether he would dare risk the wrath of the Trump administration, or there's a possibility the Trump administration might welcome that, because this would be a collaboration by American leaders to bring about peace in Northeast Asia, and what could be better?
Hmm.
So I don't know where that will go. I have personally written to President Carter, and I have published something to this effect. And since President Carter volunteered to go to Pyongyang to help work out a peace settlement, I think it's in everybody's interest that his offer be taken up enthusiastically and supported and implemented.
Carlo, we really appreciate this late-breaking report. Thank you very much for sharing it with our listeners.
You're welcome. Have a good day.
You too.
That was Carla Stea reporting from the UN in New York. Michelle Chosudovsky has a number of speaking events in Canadian cities over the next month, all focused on North Korea and the threat of nuclear war. On Monday, December 18th, he will speak in Hamilton, Ontario, at the New Vision United Church at 24 Main Street West, starting at 7 p.m. Then on Tuesday, December 19th, he speaks in Toronto at A Different Booklist Bookstore at 777 Bathurst Street, just south of the Bloor Subway. Doors open at 6:30. And on Monday, January 15th, Michelle Chosudovsky will speak in Winnipeg at 7 p.m. Preparations are underway for a Vancouver event as well. Please visit globalresearch.ca for updates. You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs weekly on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, please email us at globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. The Global Research News Hour will be on hiatus for the next 2 weeks. We'll be back with more great shows in January. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Have a happy holiday season and best wishes for 2018.